a través de esas instituciones, la clase dominante hegemónica puede difundir, extender y colocar en todos los planos de la vida su ideología, la ideología de la clase dominante.
Marx taught us that capitalism came to dominate the world via colonialism, expanding the reach of the tentacles of the bourgeoisie. Gramsci taught us that this process is not limited to just the economic sphere. The ruling class establishes its hegemony via institutions of its making or under its control, spreading its ideology throughout society like the venom of a snake, coursing its way into every aspect of our lives. The ruling class must establish its hegemony in order to assure its survival. And cultural production is critical to this process. Dominance over what is perceived as culture, dominance over what is or is not allowed to be made, dominance over our cultural lives is indispensable for capitalism to reproduce itself. As Simón Bolívar said in his address at the Congress of Angostura, "We have been ruled more by deceit than by force." We fall to the bourgeoisie's deceit when we allow them free rein over cultural production. So in the same sense that the bourgeoisie needs to maintain its hegemony via its institutions, so too must revolutionary forces produce counter-hegemonic culture. Welcome to the Venezuela Analysis Podcast. I'm your host, José Luis Granado Ceja. The Venezuela Analysis Podcast brings you independent, on-the-ground, English-language coverage of Venezuela and the Bolivarian process. You'll hear news and in-depth analysis about the country, as well as coverage of leftist and grassroots forces. On today's episode, we're talking about culture as a site of political struggle. To address this topic, we'll speak with Luigino Bracchi Roa, a communications activist, expert in digital communications, and a rank-and-file worker in Venezuela's Ministry of Culture. But first, we'll speak with Venezuela Analysis staff writer and columnist Andreina Chavez about music as a space for constructive criticism within the Bolivarian process, and the role of cultural expressions, such as the Gaita Zuliana, as a reflection of the central place that the voices of the people should occupy. Hello, Andreina. Welcome to the program. It's good to have you as always. And we were talking actually before we started recording about this song by Sandino Primera. He's the son of the famous communist singer-songwriter Ali Primera that's been playing on the airwaves a lot. It's been listened to a lot in Venezuela recently. And in that song, Sandino touches on some delicate subjects, actually. The need for a liberatory process to reorient its gaze inward to the people, about the opportunists who infiltrate our movements and our parties, about the need for the masses to be the protagonists of revolutionary change. And I was struck about how honest those lyrics were, in a way, saying things that perhaps you can't say elsewhere, except in song. So now that Venezuela is in the midst of a presidential election, and as we know, in these processes, there's enormous pressure from everywhere to quote-unquote close ranks, right? To line up behind the candidate, to put criticism aside, to get the person elected, and then deal with, you know, the contradictions later, as we often hear. So in your opinion, given this context, with this song as an example, what role do you think music and art plays in actually being able to amplify constructive criticism?
Hi, José Luis. Always happy to be on the Venezuela Analysis Podcast. I'm so glad you brought up this song about Sandino Primera, because I've been listening to this song a lot these past few days. Just to make a quick introduction, as you said, Sandino is the son of Ali Primera, who tragically died in 1985, but continues to be Venezuela's most important popular singer, precisely because his songs are about social protests, are about criticism against neoliberal governments and their alliance with Washington. You know, Ali Primera actually has two songs about Zulia State. Zulia State is where I'm from. And in these songs, he talks about how Zulia, it is a land devastated by foreign oil companies. One of these songs is called Tia Juana, and tells the story of Ali himself meeting a man who is living in despair, who has been abandoned by the Venezuelan state. And the lyrics say, and I quote, "At the time, all I had to give was my son to help him amplify his struggle, to help him amplify his cry." So Ali Primera sang about the struggles of the working class, and his songs, I believe, are a perfect demonstration of the role music and art can play to provide constructive criticism and to amplify the voice of the people. You know, in fact, Ali Primera was a huge influence on President Hugo Chavez and the developing of his own political consciousness. So, well, back to the song that you were mentioning in your question, the song by Sandino Primera. This is a song that I think it came out in 2021. It is called Desahogo y Palante, which translates to something like, I don't know, I vent my feelings and then I continue, which is a really good title. And even though this song is a few years old, it has suddenly found like a second wind these days, you know, because people in Venezuela are thinking about the presidential elections in July. They are thinking, they are discussing about all the internal issues and contradictions that the revolutionary movement faces today, as well as all the external threats like the imposition of US sanctions on the oil industry. So this beautiful song by Sandino, as you said, it touches some very delicate subjects, like the fact that we need to continue finding ourselves, we need to continue reaffirming our political identity and our culture as Venezuelans, as Latin Americans. We need to openly discuss our problems and make some self-criticism about this collective life project that is called the Bolivarian Revolution, so we can fix these issues, so we can find relief and continue. I think the song, in a way, offers some insightful criticism about the divisions that you see today in Venezuela, you know, among those who fully support the Venezuelan government and those who do not support the government but are Chavistas or at least they still believe in the Bolivarian project. And the song highlights like the common ground that these two groups have, you know, and emphasizes the importance of not letting these divisions pave the way for the enemies of the country to take advantage, you know, because these are the people who destroy our country in past decades. These are the people who are allies of US imperialism. These are the people who are allies of Zionism. So we cannot allow that these divisions, as difficult as they are, to pave the way for these people to take back control of the country, you know, especially after everything we've been through. So to me, I think the message of the song is that whether you agree with the government or not, we both want this project to succeed. We both want things to change for the better. We both oppose US imperialism, and we need to find all these things that unify us and work together. So to me, that means that the government should not classify all people with criticism as traitors, nor should people who do not support the government make the suicidal decision to align with opposition factions who have called for sanctions against the country and who have caused so many troubles for the Venezuelan people. And I want to quote a part of the song because I think Sandino simplified this message in the song in a very good way. He says, "Do not dream that changing the government will quickly fix the problems that we have. We must organize ourselves and together channel the energy that we have." So as you can see, it is a song that it has in a very good way, it has sparked debate within the Venezuelan left, and it has made us see that kind of internal criticism, that kind of debate, is something that only music and culture can do, because it makes us talk about these issues without confrontation, because it touches our feelings. You know, you listen to this song and you feel seen, you feel like oh wow, this song really makes my heart feel like, you know, it makes me think about things. It makes me become all nostalgic and reflect about our past and our present. So I think this is this type of music, this type of cultural expression that is about social protest, that is about reaffirming our political identity. I think it is very important nowadays because we are facing a presidential election in July that is going to be very important for the future of our people. So in my way of seeing things, if the Maduro government wins, we are going to need more constructive criticism, especially through music and through art, if we want to rescue the essence of the Bolivarian project, which, as we all know, it was having the working class people as protagonists and their well-being was always like the most important achievement. So yeah, I think that both Ali Primera and Sandino Primera, with their music, they sort of teaches us like how constructive criticism is important and how music can truly, truly make us think about decisions and talk about it without confrontation.
I'm really glad you highlighted that part of the song because that actually jumped out at me as well. That was one of the parts that I most liked and I thought about including it in the program as well. You just mentioned that you're from Zulia State, from Maracaibo, and the music that's most associated with that state is gaita. Not to be confused with the gaita, which is bagpipes, but it's a style of music. And I think most people, if they are familiar with it, they think of Christmas music. It's what you hear most in Venezuela around Christmas time. But that style of music is actually really interesting if you look into the history of it. It goes beyond, obviously, just Christmas music. It's often been used as protest. And one of the interesting things I read about it is that it's sometimes done in like a participatory manner where people get in a circle and join in with their own lyrics, kind of following the rhythm of the song. And it actually made me think a lot about Chavez's own vision of a participatory democracy, which is that there should be a place for people to have a central role, not just like a token role, but a central role to actually sing the lyrics, to actually decide about the important issues facing the country. So I wanted to ask you, as somebody from Zulia, what effect can protest music like La Gaita Zuliana have on people developing a political consciousness? Not just denouncing, not just social protest saying like this is wrong, like we were just talking about, but actually using art and culture and music to understand that the place of the working class should be central, that they should be afraid of putting their voice up front and center. Tell us a little bit your thoughts about that.
Yeah, so that is a great question. I want to start by explaining that gaita, as you said, has nothing to do with the instrument gaita from European countries. Gaita in Venezuela is a musical expression that comes from Zulia State in Western Venezuela. In Venezuela, if you want to, the way that you're going to see a gaita being performed, it is a group of musicians. You're going to see powerful singers, like a lead singer and then background singers, and a lot of other musicians that are going to be playing instruments like maraca, tambora, furro, cuatro. These are all the instruments that they make sound by being struck or by the vibration that they create. So yeah, that's the Venezuelan gaita. And nobody knows exactly how gaitas originated, but like everything in Venezuela, they are a mix of our African and indigenous ancestors and of course the Spanish colonization. It is believed that African slaves who were living in these big haciendas south of the Maracaibo Lake were the ones who began performing gaitas, composing gaitas, singing gaitas, playing gaita instruments as a way to protest against the white slavers, you know, the colonizers. So, and on top of that, they also use gaitas as a way to resist through celebration. And they often did that during Christmas times because as it happens, they had sort of like a bit of free time to call it that way during Christmas time. So because of this history, gaitas sort of evolved to become songs about religious things, but also about Christmas celebrations, combined with criticism against government, criticism against authorities, as a way to protest poverty, inequalities, injustices created by the political class. So going back to your question, so one of my favorite memories as a little girl, when I was a child, was actually listening to gaitas with my dad. My dad had like this huge collection of gaitas, you know, in CDs, like huge collections. And he knew every single song. He knew every single story behind this, every single song. So it is one of my favorite memories because this is how I learned about Venezuelan history. This is how I learned about the country's political and socioeconomic problems. And the people singing these songs were people who lived in neighborhoods very similar to my own. You know, so in many ways, gaitas were part of my introduction into developing political consciousness. So like I said, I would hear the lyrics of dozens of gaitas, and I would ask my dad the meaning of the lyrics, and it was almost always something about, yeah, this is because the country was lacking democracy back in the day, because we had a huge number of poverty, because the government was involved in huge corruption scandals, because the government had just enacted a neoliberal recipe, and the Venezuelan people were fed up with all of that, and they wanted to live with dignity. So I think gaitas and music in general were truly helpful when it came to shaping people's political views and creating the conditions for the country's popular rebellions, both in the 80s and the 90s. And before Chavez came to power, at least for my dad it was, and it was for me too. And like you said, gaita sort of made us feel like we could use music to become protagonists of the change that we wanted to see in the country. So people use gaitas as a way to say, yeah, this is my country, this is what happened, this is what I feel about it, this is what I've been going through. And this was the way for people to sort of like, say, yeah, I have the right to protest against this. I have the right to talk about these issues. And it sparked conversation between families, like it did between my dad and me and my sisters. So I think, I mean, to wrap it up, I think that music and culture in general are a powerful way for people to feel like they are the protagonists of the change that they want to see, that they have a way to protest injustices, they have a way to resist. I don't want to pretend that I know exactly what is happening to gaita productions nowadays, but I do feel like we might not see gaitas today with that same strong political messages as before. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that Venezuela has gone through such difficult economic circumstances these past few years, because as you know, we've gone to an economic crisis under US sanctions, and that has affected cultural production a lot. Like, cultural production has suffered a lot because of the crisis. And when it comes specifically to Zulia State, where gaitas are from, all these problems that you see in Venezuela are even worse. I mean, Zulia today is still suffering from electricity blackouts. The local economy is suffering a lot because of that. People's quality of life is also suffering a lot. You know, I think we really need to understand that as the country starts to recover, we probably are going to see more gaitas, more music, more culture, like the Santino song, that are going to reflect these problems. So I think that we need music to talk about these regions in Venezuela that are often forgotten because they are so far away from the capital, from the political center of Venezuela. But at the same time, they are the regions that suffer the most. And just because off the top of my head, there is a song by a famous gaita singer, Ricardo Aguirre, who is probably one of the most famous gaita singers in Venezuela. And the song says something like this, and I quote, "Zulia suffers religiously from national neglect." And this is a song from the 80s. I think it's from the 80s. Maybe it is even from the 70s. And the message stands today. And I think that's the beauty of music as a way to express what is happening in the country. That it connects the past with the present. It makes us see that there are a lot of things that haven't changed. there are a lot of things that we still need to work on. And it is a way to tell the authorities, hey, look, this is Zulia State. This is where, this is the old capital of Venezuela. This is where the country's oil industry was born back in the early 1900s. And back then, it was one of the most neglected regions of the country. And today, it has gone back to being one of the most neglected regions of the country, precisely because the crisis has been so severe. U.S. imperialism has been so severe that the whole in Venezuela in its entirety has suffered. But then we have these regions in the periphery who are even worse. I often say that one of the worst things that can happen to you is having been born or having grown up near the oil industry, near where the oil was found, you know? And so, yeah, I think I deviated a little bit from the subject, but the basis of this is that through culture and music, you can definitely make people feel seen. People can definitely become protagonists of their own stories.
I really enjoyed that anecdote you shared about listening to the music with your family, with your father, and asking questions. And I can't help but think that happened millions of times over and over again. And I think what you said about sort of the dialectical relationship of the way that these zones of exploitation continue to kind of pass through the same cycles, right? There's a lot of lessons there that I think precisely if we were to write a song today, it would probably have a lot of the themes from the 80s that you heard as a child. So I have one last question for you. And this has to do with a little bit of the context in which actual cultural production gets out there. You know, I was thinking about the decision by the Chavez government back in 2007 to not renew the concession to RCTV, so this television channel, clearly allied with the bourgeoisie, very, very aggressive posture towards the government, et cetera, et cetera. And it was a very controversial decision to not renew the concession. It was met with fierce resistance by the bourgeoisie and by political forces. And one of my favorite speeches is actually Chavez holding a demonstration to explain the reasons behind the decision. And he actually goes through the effort of explaining Gramsci's concept of hegemony. And he talks about how civil society tries to, and I love the way he says it, bathe our society with their ideology, that they try to impose their way of understanding concepts like freedom. And I'm reminded of a couple of incidents recently where we saw the way that objective situations were manipulated. I think about what's happening right now with the genocide in Palestine. Then I saw a recent study that 48% of people in the U.S. don't know that more Palestinians than Israelis have been killed in this genocidal campaign. It's extraordinary. How is it possible that they don't know what's actually happening? A lot of it has to do with the fact that the U.S. is full of channels like RCTV, which is just putting out propaganda, basically, in favor of the Israeli campaign. And I think about La Batalla de los Puentes in Venezuela, where they tried to convince the world that Maduro was burning humanitarian aid, right? And so my question is, why is it necessary for the working class to not just create counter-hegemonic cultural productions, having music like we just talked about from Sandino or the Gaitas that denounce injustices, but actually view our ability to transmit this kind of cultural production as a site of struggle, where we actually should be thinking about how we take away the bourgeoisie's ability to spread their ideology for us so it's not so that we become the hegemonic force in society? Tell us what you think about that.
So yeah, that is a very good Hugo Chavez speech from 2007, one of many amazing Hugo Chavez speeches. And there's a moment in the speech that where he makes me laugh because he says that the dominant civil society in Venezuela, you know, those who own the media, the government, the economy, they try to convince him to turn into one of them. Like they try to make him into one of his puppets or something like that. And he says in the speech, "What I am Montuno." Montuno means that, you know, that he is from the countryside, that he's humble, that he's one of the people. So that part of it always makes me laugh. And it also reminds me that the opposition, the Venezuelan opposition today, continues to sell this idea that they are the civil society of Venezuela. that they need to rule the country again because they need to bring civilization to Venezuela once more. Because in their racist belief, we are not civilized. People who are Chavistas or who are who support the government, we are not civilized society. They are. So yeah, I think that and you have to remember that this is the same opposition that did rule Venezuela for more than 5 decades before 1995, and they did absolutely nothing for the working class. So when they talk about civilized society, they are only talking about themselves. They don't care about other people. So yeah, so back to the speech that you were mentioning. As you were saying, he makes some really excellent points, you know, when he explains how civil society brainwashes people with their ideology, and they do it through the Catholic Church, they do it through the education system, but most importantly, they do it by dominating everything that we consume, the news, the media, the movies, the songs, comedy, even beauty contests like Miss Venezuela. I'm sure that everyone in the world knows about Miss Venezuela. But Miss Venezuela is a beauty contest that for so many decades has made Venezuelan women like me feel like the only acceptable beauty standard in the world is that of the European woman, you know? And so they have dominated us through so many ways, you know? And I think we can allow that. We can't just allow them to do that, to continue to do that. We need counter-hegemonic culture production, and we need news, we need news channels and media outlets like Venezuela Analysis, like Del Sur, like so many others that exist today, to validate our political identities, to validate our culture, to validate ourselves as people who come from African and indigenous ancestors, to see ourselves as Latin Americans, you know, as people who have a lot in common. Venezuelan, Colombians, Peruvians, Ecuadorians, we all have so much in common. We need to be seeing each other, not seeing to the United States or to whatever they define as society, as civil society, and all of that. So I like the example that you gave about Palestine. I believe it to be true. I completely believe that people in the U.S. probably think that they probably don't even know that there's a genocide happening, or they probably don't even know that the majority of the victims are Palestinians. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that the U.S. cultural hegemony, the U.S. cultural imperialism, hides the truth from its own people by controlling the news. And I think they try to do the same with the rest of the world. You know, for example, one discussion that I often see on social media these days is people from the U.S., but also from other parts of the world, saying that it was the U.S. who defeated the Nazis, and that the U.S. liberated the people from Iraq, the people from Afghanistan, that the U.S. is trying to bring democracy to Cuba, is trying to bring democracy to Venezuela, that sanctions are absolutely irrelevant because they do absolutely nothing to affect the economy of these countries. You know, complete lies and inaccuracies. But they do that because the news channels that they own, they convince people of these lies. So yes, we definitely need to take control of media outlets. We need to take control of every kind of cultural production that we can have. So how exactly do we fight this from the camp of culture? I think the answer is that, in many ways, and I think this is going to sound ridiculous to some people, but I think in many ways we need our own Hollywood, you know? Like Venezuela and Latin America in general needs its own Hollywood. And of course I'm talking about the people, I'm talking about the left. We need, like, you know, to create these productions that are going to talk about our stories, that are going to talk about our people, about our struggles, about the working class struggles. And I think in Venezuela we already have the basis for that. In 2006, Hugo Chavez created Villa del Cine. Villa del Cine was created precisely to break with the Hollywood dictatorship, you know, and to try to counter capitalism, to try to show the people what socialism is about, what the Bolivarian Project is about. To this day, there are many productions by Villa del Cine that are quite good, that are really, really good, that tell stories about Venezuelan history, Venezuelan politics. They tell human stories about our country. I think we already have the tools, we already have the talent to do this, to create sort of like our own Hollywood. And I believe that as the country continues to recover from all these economic struggles in the past few years, I think I'm pretty certain that we are going to prioritize the creation of country hegemonic culture productions, especially movies. In fact, I was reading recently that they are making a movie about Hugo Chavez. They are making a movie about his life, I don't know the details yet, but it is very exciting. And I was thinking, yes, this is exactly what we need. We need movies about Hugo Chavez, we need movies about Che Guevara, we need movies about everything that Venezuela has gone through in the past 25 years. We need movies explaining how Hugo Sanchez has affected people, but we need these movies to be told from the perspective of the people. We need it to be like, you know, human stories. And we also need to show the world all the beautiful experiences that we have in Venezuela, because Venezuela still have a lot of socialist experiments that continue to prosper. And we need to show the world about them. And we need to show the world how we have resisted and overcome all these obstacles that US imperialism has imposed on us. So I suppose that my only, not criticism, but my only, the perspective that I have about Villa del Cine and about the movies that we are creating is that we need to find a way to make them more present across Venezuela. Because if you go to a movies, if you go to the movies today, anywhere in Venezuela, you're going to find that 99% of what they are showing is Hollywood movies, you know? So it's very difficult to sort of like watch movies from Villa del Cine because you don't know where they are. They get announced and you can see them in the movies, like in the first place when they are new, and then they sort of like disappear. You don't know where you can find them again. So we do need to find ways to make sure that these movies are present in Venezuela, you know? That we can show them in schools, that we can show them in universities, that we can have them, that they can be available, you know? So yeah, I think, like I said, I think it might sound ridiculous to some people, the idea of having our own Hollywood, but I think we need to. I think we need movies that, I think if we do that, we can have a huge impact, not only in Venezuela, but we can have a huge impact on the world, because they could see what the Bolivarian Project is actually about, and they could see that these type of political movements are actually really hopeful for humanity.
Absolutely. And I think we need to remember that if Hollywood exists, it's because it has an audience. And if we were able to shift that audience to pay attention, to gaze, to enjoy, to listen to this counter-hegemonic cultural production, well, they would begin to be marginalized, right? We have that power. We just have to be able to actually exercise it. And I think it's something that as simple as talking to our friends and neighbors, to our family about consuming things differently. And obviously having that vision of understanding that what we're doing isn't just choosing the alternative, but actually cultivating a different form of understanding the world, right? One that favors the working class, one that isn't assigned to us by the ruling class. And I think if we think of it that way, there's a very strong political dimension of a long-term vision of what this is actually all about, because it's indispensable, right? As much as we think about political struggles taking place in a political realm, we can never forget that the cultural realm is just as important. Thanks so much, Andreina. This was a really exciting conversation with you. I really appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with us and sharing so much about the culture of Venezuela.
Thank you so much, José Luis. It was a pleasure to be on the podcast and hope to see you again.
¿Qué ocurre cuando Hugo Chávez llega al gobierno de Venezuela? La sociedad civil dominante trata de adueñarse de Chávez, pero Chávez salió montuno. Chávez nunca se ha subordinado y Chávez jamás se subordinará a esa vieja sociedad civil del Pacto de Punto Fijo.
In our next segment, we will speak with Luigino Bracchi Roa, communications expert and a fierce defender of Venezuela and its various cultural expressions on social media. He works at the Ministry of Culture and with the Alba Ciudad radio station. You can follow him and read his prolific posts on social media, at Lubrio. Braquidroa speaks to us about the rich cultural heritage of his country, the inaccurate depictions of Venezuela in popular media outside the country, and the challenges faced by cultural workers in trying to produce new works with insufficient resources. Welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us. So many revolutionary thinkers, including Hugo Chavez, have spoken or written about culture as a site of political struggle. In the case of Venezuela, historically so close to the U.S., and previously with decades of submission to the interests of the global North, we see strong pressure emanating from that hegemonic culture. In your opinion, and based on the project you have participated in, like Alba Ciudad, what is the role of arts in uniting the people in favor of a class project and common objectives? How do you think that struggle can be carried out?
Yo trabajo en el Ministerio de la Cultura. Soy trabajador de allí. En ningún momento estoy hablando en nombre de ellos, sino estoy hablando a título personal. Pero soy trabajador del Ministerio de la Cultura desde el año 2009.
I work at the Ministry of Culture. I'm a rank and file worker there. I am not speaking on their behalf, but solely on a personal basis. I have been working at the Ministry of Culture since 2009. I have to be honest with you, when I started there, I truly was very ignorant about many, many cultural matters, to the point that I'm even embarrassed to admit it. For example, I used to think that the Dancing Devils were only from the state of Yer. I didn't know that there were at least 11 confraternities of Dancing Devils from states such as Cojedes, Aragua, Carabobo, and even La Guaira. I used to think that the only Joropo that existed was the Llanero Joropo. I didn't know about the Joropo Tuyero. The first time I heard Joropo Tuyero, and I say this with all the embarrassment in the world, I made a face and thought, what is this? Why does it sound like this? Initially, it even sounded unpleasant to me. It wasn't until someone sat down with me to explain the origins of the Joropo Tuyero, where it came from, why it was played only with a harp with metal strings and a person playing maracas, and another person singing, and why the Venezuelan cuatro wasn't used. Later, little by little, I began to understand many other traditions, the Tamunangue Larense, the Golpe Tocuyano, about the different musical traditions in eastern Venezuela, the Malagueñas, the Yotas, the Diversiones Orientales, the drums. The drums on the coasts of Venezuela are very varied and they're all so different. You may have heard a lot about the drums from here in the state of Miranda, but those from the state of Aragua are different. The ones from Coro are completely different. Those in Cabimas are also completely different. There are a lot of traditional drums. According to experts, there are more than 300 types just here in Venezuela. I have to say, every time I learn something new, I feel humbled. Every small thing I learn makes me realize the vast amount of things out there left to learn. There are a number of traditions here in Venezuela precisely created by the syncretism by African slaves who were forcibly brought to Venezuela and who sought ways to maintain their traditions, often mixing them because they could not practice their own traditions. They were forced to adopt the Catholic religion, and they had no choice but to mix the Catholic traditions with their own African traditions in order to preserve them, which led to this syncretism. I didn't even know what syncretism was 15 years ago. It led to a wonderful syncretism. Similarly, many of the traditions of Venezuelan indigenous people have also been preserved mixed into these traditions. These are things that we must defend. As you yourself say in the question, there is enormous pressure from the United States, from different cultural industries, mainly the hegemonic American one, but it's not the only one, because Venezuela, for better or for worse, is right in the middle of the American continent. We receive many influences from above, from the North, from the United States, Canada, but also from other countries that have very consolidated cultural industries like Spain, for example, from Colombia, which has a strong presence, also from Argentina, from Chile, from the Caribbean itself, from Puerto Rico, from the Dominican Republic, the influence from salsa and merengue music, etc. So we're on the receiving end of strong influences, which on one hand is really nice because Venezuelans here are experts in all musical genres, especially those who are more music lovers, those who are more open to all genres. Here there are people who like rock, who like merengue, who like salsa, who like vallenato. That is really cool in a certain sense. But on the other hand, it is also very problematic when it comes to maintaining our traditions, because we have this strong influence, this strong pressure, even commercially. When someone proposes something like, let's make a radio station, or let's do a music project, or let's do an artistic project, one always has to try to have mass appeal. So there's sometimes people forget about our traditions and go more towards what is more popular, let's say. And that brings problems. So this is where projects like Alba Ciudad, which is the radio station where I work, and the different projects of the Ministry of Culture become more important. They exist precisely to maintain and help showcase all those traditions that exist throughout the country. Many times, the cultural practitioners come to us to tell us that they feel abandoned, as if they are all alone. They feel overwhelmed by a cultural industry that attacks them from all sides, and that they increasingly feel more insignificant. You can go into the interior of the country, and if you tune into the radio stations in certain towns or cities, almost all of them are broadcasting vallenato, reggaeton, and only commercial music. There isn't even a single station that broadcasts traditional music from that city or region or from that place where you currently are. That is quite serious. My personal stance is that there should be something like Alba Ciudad, perhaps under a different name, in every town. A traditional radio station in every city and place in the country dedicated solely to playing traditional music from that area. Simply put, in the vast majority of cities and towns, as the cultural practitioners themselves will tell you, people feel overwhelmed by the industry because commercial stations want to play music that sells, music created by the cultural industry, or music that they imagine to be the most popular, leaving traditional music behind. That's a place where we at the radio station feel proud about the impact of some of the projects we've created. For example, we use open source software, and we have developed our own applications, like one that allows all the songs we have on the radio to be automatically shared on the internet, especially the national and traditional ones. We received positive feedback from people who work in community radio stations, and even some in commercial partner stations, thanking us because thanks to this project, they have been able to download and include in their collection many traditional songs that they wouldn't have been able to find otherwise. We are very proud of that. We are very proud of the contribution we have made to help spread traditional Venezuelan music, and hopefully we can do much more. Sometimes the circumstances make things difficult, such as the issue of blockade, the sanctions, low wages, and low budgets. Many times, we have to fix things ourselves, in an artisanal way, or even putting money from our own pockets because there is no budget, plain and simple. But still, we are very proud of what we've accomplished, and hopefully, we can continue to do many more projects to help make more visible everything that is being done by the government, the Ministry of Culture, and by these new projects that are emerging, such as Gran Misión Viva Venezuela, among others.
Ministerio de la Cultura y desde nuevos proyectos que estén naciendo como la Gran Misión Viva Venezuela, entre otros, ¿no?
Recently, you made a very popular video on YouTube criticizing the movie Simón, which was a Hollywood-like film about the violent street protests led by right-wing forces in Venezuela, known as Guarimbas. What is the political effect of the efforts to position this movie as representative of Venezuela outside of the country?
Bueno, José Luis, tú que estás fuera de Venezuela, tú mismo debes estar consciente de cómo fueron llevados los hechos ocurridos en el año 2014 y 2017.
Well, José Luis, you being outside of Venezuela must be aware of how the events of 2014 and 2017 surrounding the Guarimbas were portrayed to the international community. Essentially, they were presented as a group of peaceful, innocent students who wanted changes in the country and who were attacked by security forces deployed by the government of Nicolas Maduro, with many of them dying from shots fired by the National Guard or the Bolivarian National Police. That is the image that mass media and international agencies presented abroad. On one hand, I won't deny that there were isolated cases of excesses by some members of the police or the National Guard against some protesters. I won't deny that it happened in some isolated cases. But in many, many, many instances of deaths that occurred during the protests in 2014, when there were 41 deaths that year, and in 2017, when there were about 150 deaths, the vast majority of those deaths were not of protesters. They were people trying to pass through the barricades created by the protesters, who unfortunately were far from being peaceful protesters. Many of these protesters were creating barricades, blocking roads simply to sow chaos. There was a very orchestrated plan behind all of this, in which money was being mobilized, and many of those protesters were very violent individuals. In some cases, they were even paid. They were not protesters, but rather criminals, who were involved in other activities and were paid to create those guarimbas, those violent protests, and to maintain a series of barricades 24 hours a day, in the afternoon, at night, with fire, with continuously burning objects, to keep those barricades up with the aim of saying that everything would be blocked until Nicolas Maduro was ousted from power. So, amid these events, many confrontations occurred, even with people who were not Chavistas or who were not affiliated with either side, for example. In some cases, they were opposition supporters who needed to pass through barricades, they needed to take people to their medical appointments, or simply needed to pass to reach their homes or workplaces, etc., etc. They became victims of these violent individuals, who in some cases beat them, in some cases shot at them, and in some cases there were people who were burned alive. Some of these individuals also attacked public institutions with workers inside and destroyed the buildings, causing injuries. There were people who set up wires across the streets because they claimed that the colectivos, as they called the Chavista motorcyclist groups, were going to make it into the neighborhoods and kill people. So they set up wires across the roads, and many times innocent motorcyclists passed down these roads, collided at high speed with those wires, and simply died. Look, the Guarimbas were truly horrifying events and bring very bad memories for all of us who lived in those areas, whether we were Chavistas, opposition supporters, or neither. We all have very bad memories of that time. None of us want them to happen again. But what I want to tell you with this long story is that the Guarimbas are not as they were presented to you, the people living outside of Venezuela. The Guarimbas are very far from that depiction. The Guarimbas were truly violent events, where, for example, Chavista supporters who living in middle-class areas were threatened. They put photos of us in WhatsApp groups with saying, "This person lives in such and such building and is a Chavista." In my case, my home address was published on Twitter. Also, groups called the Penguins, HDP, etc., would publish information about Chavistas. And I tell you, not just well-known personalities who appeared on television, ministers, deputies, but often ordinary Chavista people, journalists, or ordinary people who work in public institutions. We were victims of quite violent harassment. It must be said as well that many of the people who were indeed victims of police or National Guard officers who committed abuses, in the majority of cases, those police officers and National Guard members have been arrested and tried, in the vast majority of cases. So then this movie Simon is released, which presents things in a very distorted way because obviously it only shows things from the point of view of the young opposition supporters. They make them look like the victim. The movie makes untrue claims, such as saying that young opposition members were detained, tortured, and killed inside Venezuelan prisons. We investigated, and we have found no record of any person being killed by torture in Venezuelan prisons. I'm specifically referring to young opposition students. We have not found any young opposition student who participated in the Guarimbas that was detained, tortured, and killed. It is true that there are many reports of torture, and these are being presented before the International Criminal Court. The Venezuelan government has said that they have reviewed them and that the vast majority of them are false or exaggerations, etc. Nonetheless, I am a person who advocates that any allegation of torture or human rights violations must be thoroughly investigated to the fullest extent. That is my personal stance. If there is indeed any official in Venezuelan prisons who is torturing or who has exceeded their duties and there is evidence of it, that person should be severely punished. I believe that any leftist would demand that. However, many of those who are presenting evidence of such are not doing it to clean up or improve the institutions, but they are doing it because they dream that one day one of these courts will order a military intervention or the arrest of officials, even the president. They believe that if a police officer exceeded their duties, it is because Nicolas Maduro personally called them and ordered them to do so, and therefore Nicolas Maduro must be arrested. That is the illusion some of them have, when in fact we remember that during the Guarimbas, the government even ordered that National Guard and police officers go unarmed, and even prohibited them from using plastic pellet guns. They prohibited their use because they could be used at point-blank range to kill people. So even those types of weapons were prohibited by the President of the Republic himself. What I want to tell you is that Simon is simply adding to those media outlets that in the past projected a skewed take, a completely wrong depiction of the Guarimbas and violent protests in Venezuela. They are showing only one side and showing it in a completely distorted way, hiding everything else. All the suffering that public workers and people in general went through in the areas affected by the Guarimbas, those who had to go through very difficult and bitter moments because of the protesters themselves and those who organized those violent protests. Because in those violent protests, a large amount of money was mobilized to commit vandalism, to put homemade explosives in the hands of 14 to 15-year-old children, and to convince children and young people to attack military bases, as happened here in Caracas, where they convinced children and young people to attack the Carlota military base and throw homemade explosives. We're talking about gunpowder-filled objects with shrapnel that can cause the same damage as a grenade, throwing that into a military base. You know very well that in any country in the world, if you do that against a military base, you will be shot dead. They did that. They convinced young people to do that because they needed the dead bodies to later victimize themselves and justify all actions against Venezuela. That is what really happened.
Hacían eso, convencían a jóvenes a hacer eso, porque ellos necesitaban los muertos para después poder
victimizarse y justificar cualquier cosa contra Venezuela. Eso es lo que en realidad pasó.
You have also previously pointed out that on the side of Chavismo and the government, there's a lack of cultural and artistic production to dispute these sorts of right-wing narratives. Where do you think the work needs to be done? Or what needs to be reoriented in order to not allow premises that are part of the imperialist agenda to take hold in the popular imagination?
Por supuesto que hacen falta producciones, películas y documentales que muestren la narrativa no solo...
Of course, there is a need for productions, movies, and documentaries that show the truth. Not just the narrative of Chavismo, as if they were two separate things. Because it also bothers me when things are done on our side that are excessively propagandistic, and no one believes them because they portray us as angels. I believe that we need to show the truth. We need to show both sides of the news, of the information. If it were up to me, I would try to also show why young opposition members resorted to organizing violent protests. They also had valid motivations to a certain extent, dreams, aspirations that had been lost, and which a group of people also took advantage of to manipulate them. I believe all of that needs to be shown, the good and the bad from both sides. I believe that truth needs to be shown with all the sincerity in the world. What's the problem then? Making any of these productions requires money. In other words, producing any kind of audiovisual content requires large amounts of money. Let's talk about what's on Netflix right now. Any TV series you watch on Netflix could have a budget of $10, $20, $30 million. While here, productions sometimes have to be made with $20,000 or much less. And similarly, these big streaming companies like Netflix, HBO, etc., also have very high technical requirements. One wants to demand the government make these kinds of productions, but it's important to recognize that it's not easy to do so. It's costly. It's also difficult to make the government step back a bit from that overly pamphlet-like vision they sometimes have. And unfortunately, this propagandistic style takes away some of the veracity of things. Doing things in the style of VTV, which is what many of us here call this style of production, where we show everything as if we were the good guys and they are demons. That kind of approach, unfortunately, takes away a lot of credibility. So in summary, I do believe that things need to be done, but it's not easy.
Thank you so much for joining us. That's our program for today. For more on the issues explored, check out Episode 4, Anti-Imperialist Media Strikes Back. One final note. I recently went on a speaking tour throughout the West Coast of the United States to talk about the anti-imperialist struggle in Latin America. With several events from Portland to San Diego, it was an enriching and fulfilling experience. I take great comfort in knowing that there are strong, principled activists inside the belly of the beast working to undermine the power of U.S. imperialism. However, the event that most stood out to me by far was a stop in Los Angeles at La Casa Roja, a community center and organizing space created by communists. As soon as I entered the space, I was drawn in by the posters and images on the walls. There was a campaign poster of Shafiq Handel, historic leftist leader from El Salvador, from his 2004 presidential run. Next to that was an image of the murdered Honduran social movement leader, Berta Cáceres. Elsewhere, there was a wood engraving of Vladimir Lenin. As soon as I saw those images, I immediately felt more at ease. This was a place I could feel at home, I thought. At the conclusion of the presentations that night, Fidel Sanchez, who had earlier played two original songs for attendees, began to sing Todo Cambia, and this incredible energy was instantly felt by everyone in the room. Having just listened to speeches about the anti-imperialist struggle, the song struck just the right note. Those who knew the verses joined in. By the time Fidel reached the chorus, everyone was singing with their whole heart. As my gaze panned the room, I saw the emotion on people's faces, and soon enough, I began to feel tears of joy welling up in my eyes, and I wasn't alone. Few of us knew each other at the start of that night's event, but by the end, we all understood that we were united. This is the power of a group of working-class people singing our songs. Ruling-class hegemony is imposed on us. It will always pale in comparison to what is authentically ours. We must reject the ruling class's so-called culture, and instead defend and spread ours. As Gramsci wrote, quote, "To achieve a revolutionary perspective, the worker must first be freed of the ideological fetters imposed on him by the cultural organizations of the ruling class." Be sure to visit us at VenezuelaAnalysis.com for regular news and analysis on all things Venezuela. We're also everywhere on social media. If you enjoyed the program, please share it with your friends. We'll end today's episode with the song La Grey Juliana by Betulio Medina.
En todo tiempo cuando a la calle sales mi reina, tu pueblo amado se ha confundido en un solo amor. Amor inmenso, glorioso, excelso, sublime y tierno. Amor celeste, divino y santo hacia su bondad. Madre mía, si el gobierno no ayuda al pueblo zuliano, tendréis que meter la mano y mandarlo para el infierno. Madre mía, si el gobierno no ayuda al pueblo zuliano, tendréis que meter la mano y mandarlo para el infierno.
Todo.